are 50 blessings. Together, we march. March into the future.
You have reached a wrong number.
We're packing hot dogs for the road. You know, hot dogs get a bad rap. They got a cool shape, they got protein. You like hot dogs, right? By the way, I think I know what's causing this.
You do?
It's the plants. They can release chemicals. You like hot dogs, don't you? Okay, babies, we are gonna be going, but we will be back soon, okay? Plants react to human stimulus. They prove it in tests. Did you get the mustard?
Episode 15 of the Plants Are People 2 podcast is brought to you by Soylent Green's new line of protein shakes. Save time. Reach your nutrition goals. Curb cravings. Soylent Green is an egocentrically portioned meal for home or on the go. Soylent Green started with the basic idea that humans are going to destroy the earth anyway, and in the meantime, complete nutrition shouldn't be difficult or expensive. Our co-founders met in 2013 in Silicon Valley, working under the same roof and eating the same diet of frozen meals and ramen noodles. After a lot of frustration, founder Charlton Heston, alongside co-founders Lee Taylor Young and Edward G. Robinson, Soylent Green is a dystopian experiment. Their hypothesis, food can be simplified but just for the better of humans. They were software engineers after all, so who better to save the planet than the people who are destroying it?
I'm sorry, can we not have these people sponsor the show this week? They sound awful.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to episode 15, Plants Are People 2 podcast. My name is Tom Groves. We have a special guest on today. Before we get into that, I wanted to just pose a question and see if other people feel this way. But looking up recipes for, you know, dinner on, you know, online, I don't know who needs to hear this, but the people that are writing those, stop with the novels. We don't need it. I just want to see what the ingredients are and what the prep takes and what I need to do to put it all together. I don't want to read about how, you know, you spent this many years taking a cooking class and you finally, like, found out that this recipe works. Just tell me that it works. Just put it there. You know, it fits on one screen, you know, on my phone, and I can just make that for dinner. I'm really tired of having to scroll for, like, you know, 10 seconds down to where you decided to put in the, randomly decided to put in the ingredients. So if you're doing that, stop it. And I'm going to let Matt do his introduction. We're going to be talking about ferns today, a very special type of fern. So with nothing else, here it is. Enjoy.
My name is Matt Charpentier. I am based in central Massachusetts, in Princeton, by Mount Wachusett. And I work as a field botanist with Oxbow Associates, an environmental consulting firm, doing permitting for wetlands and endangered species, predominantly endangered plants. And I am also the vice president of the New England Botanical Society.
You know, I always wondered, before we get into the fern thing, can you just say a little bit more about Oxbow Associates? You know, I guess it would be a common topic for people who are about to get out of school or go into the field of botany or plants. How does that work with Oxbow? Like, people are paying you to go do rare plant surveys?
Yeah, so in Massachusetts, rare plants are protected under the Massachusetts Endangered Species Act on both public and private property. And so if there's a known population of a state-listed plant, in order to, you know, alter vegetation, build anything, essentially do anything that alters the land or the plant community there, you need to go through a review process with the state. And part of that for the plants is doing a survey for rare plants and then a delineation. And the most simple method to get through these legal loopholes is avoidance. And so we're most often hired by private landowners or utility companies to go out and survey for rare species, conduct studies both for plants and animals, oftentimes, you know, snakes and turtles as well, and then work with the state to come up with a plan and the client, the landowner, to figure out a path forward that minimizes impact to the listed species.
New England Botanical Society. So you're the vice president now. And
yeah.
You're soon to be president? Or is that letting the cat out of the
possibly.
Bag?
Possibly. Well, it's up for a vote. So I'm on the ballot and we'll see what happens.
Gotcha. So you're
it looks like that'll happen.
A candidate.
Candidate, yes.
Can you just talk a little bit about the society and what they do and maybe how someone can get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were formerly the New England Botanical Club. And as of last year, we are the New England Botanical Society. We're a nonprofit based out of Harvard University, and that's where we house the herbarium collection. We have the largest herbarium collection for specimens in New England in the world. I think we're up over 100,000 somewhere. I should know the exact number. And we meet on a monthly basis throughout the dormant season, I guess you could say, more or less, up until June. And we have monthly meetings where we invite in speakers and members and the public alike can come tune in. And then we have field trips and outings. It's a research organization as well, in the sense that we publish a quarterly publication, Redora, and it's been around since the 1890s, so quite long-standing. And as far as people getting involved, I mean, just joining in on the meetings and coming on our outings and meeting people is an excellent opportunity to network. And we're always seeking volunteers to help out behind the scenes. It's predominantly volunteer run as far as the inner workings go. And so we can always use extra hands and ears.
I have to renew my membership.
Yeah, it is that time
soon.
Of year. We're forgetting.
it's just been quite a winter so far. But I do always enjoy seeing those emails with those, you know, most recently it's been Zoom talks, but they are, you know, it's a valuable thing, especially in the dormant season, to be learning more about plants.
Certainly. Yeah. And then you also have a connection with the Native Plant Trust too. Is that right?
Yeah. I worked for them in 2014 as one of their fellows, which was really, I was really using that as a supplement to my Framingham State or Framingham University now, I guess, education in wildlife biology. So I wasn't, you know, I took plant taxonomy classes and I took like what they had to offer. But, you know, in order to get that other education, I started volunteering with Dan Jaffe and doing some like horticultural stuff. And then, you know, I knew that when those fellowships came up, like everyone would already know who I was, but I felt like it was giving me, you know, the opportunity to do something that I wanted to be doing in my education. And it was awesome.
Yeah,
I loved
absolutely.
It was so much fun. I learned a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of the skills, just like reaching out to people, trying to get permissions to go on properties, learning how to negotiate that on the phone, you know, getting to see a lot of really cool plants and, you know, the seed cleaning wasn't my favorite thing to do, but you know, it, you were immersed in it. You know, it was like everyone.
Yeah.
John Burns was really into it. It was just everyone had, and Amanda was there. And so it was just like this passionate group of people. Yeah, Burnsy. And
yeah, totally. Yeah, I was there 2 years after you. So I totally get everything. For me, the permissions was my least favorite part, but an essential duty nonetheless.
Yeah, I felt like I had a gift to like convince people that they should trust us.
I think you need it in that position sometimes.
yeah, you definitely do. Do you want to introduce the fern and talk about how cool this thing is?
Totally. Yeah, totally. So the subject fern is weft fern, Crepidomenes intricatum, also known as Trichomenes intricatum. And just as like a backstory to this, I had gotten interested in looking for unreported populations of rare plants following my fellowship with the Native Plant Trust. And poking around Talus Slopes became one of my favorite places to go. And I was crawling around this one Talus Slope one day with the state botanist in Massachusetts, Bob Warnerell, and we're looking around and we're thinking, oh, this could be a good place for this weft fern. And neither of us had seen it in person at that point. And so, you know, after leaving the site, we didn't find it. And he suggested I reach out to Jennifer Garrett, who has worked with the state in Massachusetts previously. I believe she's a consultant now. And she gave me some recommendations for how to go about finding it. And it was basically, rocky slopes, somewhat moist, on the darker side, and, you know, shales and schists tended to be good spots. And so I went out one day and I looked at a talus slope in central Mass, and sure as heck, I found it, or I thought I found it. And then I went to two other sites the same day, and I thought I found it at both those other sites as well. And this led me to reaching out to, at the New York Botanical Garden. I can't recall his name right now.
It's okay.
Global fern expert, of course, but it'll come to me. Yeah. Yeah. And he confirmed my identification. And so basically this fern, it in fern life cycles, there's the sporophyte phase, which we're all familiar with. It's the leafy green, produces spores, and it's the archetype of what someone pictures as being a fern. And then there's the other half of the life cycle, the gametophyte phase, which looks a lot more like a liverwort for most fern species. But for Crepidomenes, it's like a filamentous thread that looks a bit like, I think like if you were to look at Cheesy Puffs under a magnifying glass, like this sort of like almost like somewhat foamy looking reflective mat of filaments, and it'll frequently grow in the dark. What most people would consider the dark, it's like up in rock crevices. And so you require a flashlight to see it and a 20X hand lens to be able to really identify it. But it reproduces asexually, and its sporophyte phase is totally unknown. So it's very possible that it's evolved to not produce the sporophyte phase.
So that was interesting to me. That was the, like, you know, the way that it's phrased, it's not known from its sporophyte phase. It sounds like,
yeah,
it's possible, but it's never been observed.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's people in science being conservative in making assertions. I guess, you know, nature tends to surprise us. So it could be out there. No one's seen it yet, though.
But it's more likely that this is just a relic kind of a reproductive and their reproductive system, and there wouldn't have been a sporophyte phase, and that was something that developed later.
It seems like it might have been that there was a sporophyte phase, but then it evolved to only produce the gametophyte phase, and the sporophyte phase more or less fell by the wayside.
And,
so sort of like backwards in terms of, I don't know how, technically independent gametophytes such as weft fern don't have a vascular system, although it's still considered to be a vascular plant. So sort of interesting to think about it that way.
And there is some debate as to, I mean, this one seems to have changed genera. What's the most current name for this?
I believe it's Crepidomenes.
I
believe Trichomanes is the older name, but only recently, maybe like 6 years or so.
It's amazing what they're doing with DNA and, the connections they're making and the changes, because now it seems like at least things will be set, kind of.
Always seems to surprise me.
So what else can we dig into about this bristle fern?
Yeah, so in New England, it's considered rare in every state where it occurs. And it's known from every state in New England except for Rhode Island. When I started looking for it, there were originally 16 known stations, but we're up to, I think, over 40 now, and we've extended the range into Canada. And it seems like it might be quite a bit more common than had been previously thought. There's a lot of questions, like at how many sites does it actually occur, out of the possible sites where it could occur? And, how does it get around? Are we interfering with its modes of reproduction? It's just a really enigmatic and cute little fern that I highly recommend everyone get out and look for under rock piles with a flashlight.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so is this connected to your survey bias?
Yeah. So when I was out surveying for weft fern, in like the literature and the stations that were known by the state at the time, were all, larger populations, and by larger populations, I mean like a couple square inches in size, which underneath a rock, it's actually relatively uncommon to find pretty good sized patches like that in New England.
You were finding those patches of that plant on your surveys?
So initially, that's what I was looking for. And they were generally between like maybe a half of a square centimeter and, 4 square centimeters. There were a couple up in Maine that we found that were a quarter of a square meter. But what I started finding was that you could find individual filaments intermixed within mosses. So just like what would appear to be really unsuitable habitat, and you'd search around for hours looking for this fern under rocks with a flashlight, and then you'd start like seeing it in like embedded growing with the moss in some places, which led me to wondering if maybe this was a case of survey bias where we have this image of what constitutes habitat for the species. And, botanists in general, this isn't really what many botanists are looking for. It's a tiny little filamentous plant that grows under rocks where really nothing else grows. There aren't many botanists looking there in the first place. And then, when you are finding it, it has to be a certain size for most people to encounter it. And in order to find smaller populations, you really have to be digging. And so the amount of time that people spend looking for it doesn't necessarily detect that. And so thinking about it from the perspective of, bias and looking at things from different scales, it could be more abundant in the environment than we think. It's just that we're not necessarily looking with the right intensity in the right places, if that makes sense.
Yeah, honestly, when I first looked at this, I can almost swear that I have seen this in different places and not recognized it at all. I probably thought it was just some kind of moss growing there. And, that's not, I generally pay attention to things in flower things that look completely different than anything else I've ever seen. And so I'm constantly looking for that thing that sort of stands out to me. And mosses, I ignore because they're all just sort of, it's just another bucket I haven't opened up yet. But now that I've seen what this looks like and sort of learned a little bit about it, I do want to, it is on my list of things to see if I can find. And I think you're probably right. And I think that, you know, every once in a while I go into, you know, GoBotany is a great website just to like deep dive into sometimes and like look at mm-hmm. different things and how they're connected. And there's sometimes plants that you find, like the one that I'm thinking of is this Canada horse bomb, Collinsonia canadensis.
Yeah.
But that one is, you know, I had been watching it on that website for years because it just looked so interesting to me. And it reminded me of the flowers looked similar to some Platanthera species.
Okay. Yeah.
Sort of that labellum, the, you know, and on the Collinsonia flower, it sort of has that fringed lower petal. And so
yeah,
they
totally.
Just look similar. And I was probably thinking about, you know, pollinators and sort of maybe maybe one sort of imitating the other, or they're vying for the same sort of pollinators. But then when you looked into Collinsonia, it was a historical plant in Vermont. And then you could look at it in Massachusetts and it was listed as, I don't even think it was listed at all. It was probably an S4 plant there, or maybe an S3.
S4.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, you know, plants don't understand boundaries, you know, the
exactly.
political boundaries that we draw. And so I was just really curious. It always nagged me that, you know, I was living in Vermont, so I wanted that plant to be, you know, somewhere in my vicinity so that I could actually see it. And it took me a few years before I saw it in Massachusetts. And when I saw it out there, I was like, okay, I've got the search ID, you know, it's always on my sort of in my brain to find that plant. And then when I went down south recently, it was everywhere and mixed in with Laportia canadensis.
Yeah. Yeah. for a little bit of extra added fun.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It has that nice, like natural acupuncture effect, but It was all mixed in, and you know the leaves look very similar. The flowers are obviously very different, but in that vegetative state, you could almost mistake one for the other. And then I have seen it more recently in Western Massachusetts, and in its vegetative state, and it's clearly that plant, and it's pretty abundant in those locations. And then so I was, you know, thinking about this plant again recently, looking up on GoBotany. And it's listed as, I think it's listed as endangered in Vermont right now. So they've since changed that status. And so that's another one that I think of as, you know, when you brought up the survey bias, I think there is a huge, you know, the plant blindness in quotations is a catchphrase right now. But I think that is a very real thing for a lot of people. You know, walking out into the woods, they see, maybe they know a few things, but like, there's so many interesting things to see out in the forest, and even just taking pictures and trying to figure them out later, you know, or just having that record or that interest. That's what's interesting to me about anywhere.
Absolutely.
And so I think there are a lot of plants out there that we're missing that are probably in higher abundance than we think they are. Getting people familiar with the possibilities of things that are out there, I think, is an important thing. And the, you know, the New England Botanical Society is doing that. Native Plant Trust is doing that. There's a bunch of, you know, younger people like you and me trying to get all that stuff out there so people get interested in their surroundings. And this is a, you know, the fern that you've been talking about, the West Fern, that's another one. Like, you know, just one text opened up a whole new thing that is on my list of things to find. That's super cool.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you said about, you know, there's always something new to find. I think, you know, no matter how long you study this stuff, there's always something new to find. And the value of just taking a picture and looking it up later with iNaturalist or, you know, looking it up on GoBotany or whatever, it is really insightful. And I had a situation a couple of years back now where I was looking for, you know, podgrass. So I think it's endangered in Vermont and it grows in like peat bogs. And it Schuchseria palustris. And it's this really neat little plant. Have you seen that before?
I haven't. Let me look it up and take a look at it.
Yeah, sure thing. Yeah. So it's a little monocot, and then the vegetation looks quite a bit like a juncus, like a rush. And I found that in Massachusetts, you could actually find it more easily in the winter than during the growing season, because it blends in with all of these other graminoids that grow out there in these peatlands. And in the winter, it sort of has like this silvery dead vegetation, and it stands out on the peat. And so you can find it relatively easily and identify it definitively by the presence of an apical hydathode, which is a plant organ used for guttation, I think. Don't quote me on that. And so I was out at a site in central Massachusetts at a bog looking for this plant. And I'm just walking around, like, looking for this one specific plant, and I saw this other lycopod growing on this peat mat. I thought, oh, that looks a little bit funky. I took some pictures of it, not really thinking much. And I got to work the next day, and I was reviewing my photographs, and I found these photographs of this lycopod, and it clicked that this wasn't a normal lycopod. This was actually this plant called Carolina bog club moss, which was regionally historic for over 60 years. And I had just stumbled on this population of it, like walking right across it, not knowing what it was. And if it wasn't for that photograph, I probably wouldn't have realized what I'd seen. And it was super exciting, but there's just so much out there to find like that. And I think that's where a lot of the beauty in learning about plants is.
That's awesome that happened. That, you know, a similar story just recently, a couple of days ago, I was like, you know, this one plant that I had taken a picture of in North Carolina was bugging the hell out of me because it had, you know, I had originally thought it was a Cellini, and I started trying to figure that out. And I, for some reason, it took me 5 months before I actually found leaves that looked like the leaves I had a picture of. And I thought that I had taken pictures of the wrong leaves of like the wrong plant by mistake. And because they weren't, I didn't have them in the same photo, right? I had the picture of the stem and the leaf, and then I had the picture of the inflorescence, but they weren't together. And so I thought that maybe I had screwed up and done the wrong thing. And that's like a globally rare species that I just happened to, I was just walking down the trail and I was actually behind everybody, but trying to catch up. So I was just snapping photos real quick of all the things I was seeing to like figure out later. And that ended up being one of them. So I gave it to the heritage organization in North Carolina. They're going to let me know if it's a new population or not. I would think being so close to a trail, they probably know about it, but it was by itself. So maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's sick.
But sometimes it takes forever to, you know, process something and like really think about it. And especially, you know, with everyone's lives being so busy, you know, taking those photos. If I hadn't taken photos, I would have never figured it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like learning a new plant and then reflecting back and you like you were saying about weft fern, like, oh, you think you might've seen that before. I have this feeling every time I learn a new plant, not every time, but often when I learn a new plant, wondering like, have I seen this before? Like it could have been at this one site way out, you know, in upstate New York. And did I take a picture of it? And I like searched through my photographs and trying to find an image of this and racking my brain. And it's fun to reflect back on past experiences with new information.
Yeah, I wish that I could go back and dig through all the photos I took, you know, through my whole life and just look at the plants that I would have taken photos of, or most recently, like getting, sometimes the iPhone doesn't always hold everything. You know, you like, sometimes you zero out and you have to start over and it kind of sucks. But I mean, with iNaturalist, at least like you get a part of what I like about that is just having a running list.
You
know, so it's totally somewhere that I can like keep a species list for like my life there and keep special things, you know. It's like a, I don't know, it's like a little collection. It's your own little digital herbarium.
Yeah. And you can look into other people's digital herbariums and get an idea of like what a plant likes for habitats. It's so useful. I love it.
Do you have any other cool stories where you found something that was not expected?
I saw that you had gone looking for dwarf mistletoe a couple of months
ago. I did,
back. Yeah, that was one I dug into in Massachusetts a couple years ago. So sort of from the perspective of survey bias, that our understanding of species distributions is based on historical and contemporary observations. But, you know, generally speaking, only a finite number of people in the population like realize what they're seeing, document what they're seeing, and then report it in a way that can be retained over time. And so, you know, how we define a species as being rare is therefore relatively limited, but still very useful. And, you know, dwarf mistletoe is one of these really interesting species where, generally speaking, its host is black spruce. You know, it's known to occur on red spruce, tamarack, and white pine in very rare occasions, but is generally tied to black spruce. And you can see black spruce in aerial imagery. And so you can go on Google Earth and look at the distribution of black spruce in our forests if you know how to identify it. And then you can go out to these sites and try to find it. And that's one sort of like on the other end of the spectrum, you know, a species that's a really good candidate for actually trying to grasp the like actual rarity versus perceived rarity of a species within a given area. And it's a really fun plant to go looking for.
Yeah, you get wet.
Yeah, you certainly do.
That's sort of like a known location that I went to for that plant. But that's another one that, you know, without really, it's so bizarre looking that you would just overlook it, I think, unless you were, you know, if you were keyed into sort of like, you know, things that look weird in the forest, which I think most of us are, you know, things that look out of place, those would be interesting things. If you saw that sort of like witch's broom up there, you know, that would draw your attention. But like actually being able to get up to see that, and I think it's a timing thing, right? So like those things vegging out in like the early spring?
Yeah, I think they might be budding like now or like the next month. And then they'll flower and, you know, grow through the growing season and then fruit and disperse their seeds come fall. But no, if you were to see it like now or after it flowers, you might not even realize that it's a distinct plant from the spruce that you're looking at. It's just so wild and out there looking.
Yeah, it looks like it's just coming right out of the stem of the black spruce.
Yeah. And then one sort of a helpful piece that I picked up was if you find a witch's broom and you're trying to figure out if it was infected by or if it is infected by dwarf mistletoe, they leave a persistent bud scale that's attached to the stem. It's like about maybe 2 millimeters in diameter in a circle, like a perfect circle. And so far as I can tell, that's a really good character for identifying either past or present dwarf mistletoe, you know, presence in black spruce.
I mean, I wonder what the, you know, if somebody were to have endless time to look at this, you know, that document that the Native Plant Trust puts out, about sort of the status of plants, you know, our teeny species in New England. You know, are you saying that they're, you know, those things are based on, you said they were based on the historical record, but there's probably a whole slew of sort of avenues and information that really hasn't been looked at or updated for a while. And nobody's really doing like statewide surveys of, every possible habitat for every possible species. So do we even really have a good sense of, I guess Massachusetts probably has a better one because of your laws. But like Vermont, I don't think that's happening here like it is in Massachusetts in terms of land use.
Yeah, I would say that, New England, generally speaking, probably does have a pretty solid grasp on what is and is not rare or what is in decline. But I think there are certainly exceptions to that. I think West Firm might be an exception and there might be other exceptions out there. But I guess it all comes down to like how we're defining rarity. And, when a new species is described, for instance, and it gets like lumped off from another, seems to always be happening with dicamphelium. How we've been tracking those species, if we've been doing a good enough job so that we can actually split that data in two. I think the New England just in general is probably pretty solid in terms of our understanding, especially given like the botanical history of the region, since the European standpoint of recording botanical, plant distributions with herbaria was established, back in like the 1700s, where our records go back to sort of being ground zero for colonization. We do have, I think, quite robust records.
Yeah. Yeah, you said it's true. I looked through your Instagram pretty recently. I saw that, this is a fairly common plant, but those Goodyears with the white leaves on them, that is really interesting. I've never seen that sort of coloration on, they're pretty common plants, especially like the pubescens species. And there's usually enough of them that you can get a good sense of sort of what the patterns are in the leaf. But those ones were, it's almost like they were bleached out.
Yeah. There was a bit of green in them. So they were still doing a bit of photosynthesis, but it being an orchid, I was just assuming that it must be getting some sort of input from like mycorrhizae or something. If I'm remembering right, it was Goodyera pubescens, but I'd never seen anything like that before. And I have sense to ever seen anything like it. Although I have heard of, like pink lady slipper sometime being like totally albino, lacking chlorophyll altogether, which I've never seen, but sounds like absolutely wild.
As like a morph?
No, I guess it would be as a morph. Yeah. Where the plant just doesn't produce chlorophyll at all.
I've seen that in like, trilliums. Some of the trilliums will have a white morph. And I've seen it in Epiphagus, the beech
drought. Oh, really? Oh, cool. Yeah.
I've seen whole stands, stands when they're like, maybe 10 inches tall or something, but they're all white.
Yeah.
And I think I did look it up in the Laura Nova Anglae, and there is a white morph in there with that plant species. But
interesting,
paying attention to those, like, this is different than anything I've ever seen before, those little moments are going to be, you always learn, that's like the little door that opens and you find out that there's a morph version of this and it's rare and you just found it, on the side of a hill somewhere.
Yeah.
I did want to ask you if you know about these, looking into that, the West Fern species, I came across, I guess it's pronounced Gemma.
Yeah.
G-E-M-M-A. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. So it's essentially, from my understanding, is with independent gametophytes, since they're not reproducing sexually, they reproduce through asexual means of propagation. So, in the case of Crepidomenes, it's, these filaments are a single cell thick, and they produce this sort of series of cells that come off perpendicularly from the main filament, and they produce this at the tip, I guess parallel to the main filament, sort of like a T sticking out from it. And the top of the T is the jemmy, and it'll break off and move around, and that's what a new individual will be produced from, this little aggregation of cells.
It's so weird.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. At a lot of these sites, I've been encountering porcupine, and so I always imagine like these little jemmy moving around on the backs of porcupine. I have no idea if it's true or not, but I like to imagine it.
The other one that I saw that does this is like the liverworts, and I don't know what the species name is on it, but I guess they're what are they called, like snake wort or something. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, it's like the neither am I. Like the licorice scented one. Sort of looks like a strip of like reptile skin.
Yeah. Marcantia.
Yeah, that's the one.
Leafy liverwort. These do that as well, right? With the.
Oh, interesting! I didn't know that.
But it says that they're dispersed by water, so that water falls down, and then they're sort of like little cups, and it must splash them out. And there's actually, if you look online, there's photos of, you can see the little groups of cells at the base of the liverwort in like re-situating themselves in the moss below it. The other one that was that I found, you know, looking into this, was Drosera putting out, you know, reproducing this way, which I think is
like from the standpoint of like a leaf producing like a little plantlet at the tip.
No, it's actually, it looks like it's getting produced like in the, it's almost like a rosette, and there's all these spatulate, you know, leaves coming out. And then in the center, there's like a, it's almost like a little cup, and there's a bunch of little balls in there. That are the gemma.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I have never heard of that before. That like Drosera just keeps getting weirder and weirder.
I know. There's, and I don't, I probably learned this, you know, I thought instantly when I saw this, I thought of that Mother of Millions plant.
Kalanchoe. Yep.
And that's what I pictured when I was reading about this. And so that weft fern can reproduce, it sort of does a, it's asexual, but through.
So it doesn't, it doesn't produce what we would call, I think, as being like typical rhizomes. It has what are rhizoids, essentially, you know, these cell, I don't know if they're a single cell or what, but they're structures that serve the function of a rhizome or of a root. But I think these are just like vegetative plant material that's asexually being used for reproduction.
And so they don't have this. Are they also using this gemma process, the gemma cups?
No. I don't believe so. They produce the gemmy from like these gemmifer cells. And they're not concentrated towards any like individual point in the plant. I think they're just more or less spread out across its
surface. I wonder how I got there. I must have got there through like the family Hymenophilaceae. Yeah, it must have been. They must have been relating them to something in this family connected to that. But that
maybe
was
it's like the kind of like structure itself. I don't know, like the fact that it comes out like a T, maybe there is some sort of water action that might assist in distribution. And like if water hits it and it like gets the right torque going, it might shoot it off or something.
Very strange.
Certainly. Yeah.
What else? Where else can we go, Matt?
There's this other site that may or may not occur in New England, but occurs in New York to our west, called Vitaria, which I don't know the common name of, but it looks a lot more like a liverwort than Crepidomenes does. And that's another one to keep your eyes out for.
Can you spell that?
Yeah. Vitaria. And then Appalachiana.
Is that, that's a species that's occurring in, not in New England, but in New York?
Yes. And I believe it occurs specifically like sandstone rock houses. I could be wrong with that. But I tend to wonder if it might be in like southern Vermont, in like the southwest portion of the state.
Is there, do you know anything about like the... I was trying to figure this out the other day because there was some, and I'll think of it in a little bit and I'll tell you what the plant species was that I was wondering about. But there are some, the soil or the geography must be different from New York to Vermont, because there's a lot of species that occur like in the Finger Lakes region, which isn't, you know, latitude wise, very different from like where I am, say.
Yeah.
So I was, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, but I was wondering just what the difference is, geographically, that makes those, it's almost like that 81 is like a line in a lot of way for, some plant species.
Yeah. I don't know the answer. It might have to do with like underlying bedrock, or maybe in the context of glaciation. And, you know, as these species moved north after the glaciers receded, it might have to do with that. But yeah, I mean, Vermont just in general is quite a bit different than the rest of New England too, right? Like all plants that are associated with the shores of Lake don't seem to occur anywhere else in the state, or many other New England states until you get to the ocean.
But so there's something definitely there. And I know that if there's somebody listening that knows what the answer is to that, please email me. Or if you, you know, want to talk about that on a show, let me know. Cause that seems like a really interesting, you know, question to explore. Cool. What else can we dig into that you're jazzed about right now?
I love meeting new people, and people that are interested in botany. So, you know, finding different ways of getting people together, is really exciting, especially, I mean, in the future when COVID's hopefully like tapers off maybe. you know, just interacting with people and finding ways of, you know, sharing experiences and insights. I think that's something that the region could use a lot more of. I don't know if you've gotten this feeling, but, you know, I felt that at times New England can be very competitive and somewhat like elitist. And so, you know, sharing information, I think, has a lot of value towards building relationships and, you know, friendships, and also building our knowledge base. But that's something that I have a lot of interest in. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know that I've ever, I got the feeling that New England was competitive because it's small.
That could very well be it.
Yeah. And, you know, for the most part, you know, everyone that I've, anyone who I've been in relationship with because of plants, it's always been great. And that's, you know, I'm probably biased in that because, you know, we share that. So I might like that person more or something, but, you know, I agree with you that sharing of information is really important. And especially with a lot of younger people who are, you know, really excited, plants seem to be having sort of this little revival right now, in a way, where, or maybe it's just, you know, sort of a changing of the guard there's sort of a lot of younger people taking over a lot more roles in plant-based conservation jobs, which I think is the right step for, you know, a lot of them have been learning. We still have that very like wise group of older botanists that are sort of like showing us a lot of things. But with, you know, new technology coming in and like all this DNA stuff and, you know, climate change, a lot of things are happening in that a lot of us being able to take up that, you know, role of being caretakers and observers, you know, I think it's really important. And I think there's a ton of room to be talking about plants, teaching, doing volunteer work, just going, having a plant walk on a Saturday somewhere, you know, just getting out there and meeting people is the best way to sort of have that conversation. And then getting people to recognize where they live, and maybe for the first time,
yeah,
you know, maybe they've never looked at it, and it's like, whoa, I've been sleepwalking my entire life. And there's just so many fascinating things to think about and wonder. So I am very glad to have met you through Chris.
Yeah, likewise.
You know, this is another...
I've heard your name around for a while, so do.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's great. I think this COVID stuff is going to go away really soon. You know, there's a whole bunch of different things that, you know, meetups, and I think this summer is going to be a really good summer, fingers crossed. And all of our botanical dreams are going to be met, everybody's. you know, it's just great to be continuing to expand sort of everyone's, you know, relationships and knowledge. And
agreed. Yeah. Yeah. Looking forward to getting back out there with folks. And, you know, I think you'd mentioned, you know, the older generation that we have such a robust contingent of people who have been doing botany in the region for so long, and there's so much to learn from them. And I think it's so exciting. Getting out there in the field is such a great way of, you know, picking up information from other people and stories, and the joy of a sort of a little subculture that we have.
Thank you so much for coming on. Do you want to plug yourself?
Yeah. Oh yeah, sure. I'm on Instagram, Plants and Mountains. And then also if you are interested in getting involved in the New England Botanical Society, we have our upcoming meeting on, I believe it's Saturday, March 5th, if I'm remembering correctly. And Alan Weekly will be speaking about the flora of the Southeast and you know, tools in developing floras. So you should tune in. And feel free to reach out to me.
And what's the NEBS website?
It is rhodora.org.
So cool. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. I hope, you know, good luck in your run for office.
I was going to say that there's actually a site, depending on where you're located in Vermont, that we should check out sometime together. It's got Peltandra virginica and some other listed species in Vermont, but I think it might have Schuchteria. But it looks like a sick site. I'll send you a GPS coordinate to it. But I've been dying to get up there, and I don't know where you're located in Vermont, but it could be a good place to meet up in the field.
I'm just outside of Brattleboro.
Oh, cool.
So it's
super far at all.
Whittingham's not too far, yeah. Yeah, I would love to do that. You know, I have my plant list for this summer and a lot of coordinates to go check out a lot of different things. So I am, you know, you tell me when you want to do it, I'll be there. All right, man. Well, thank you so much again. And
likewise, Tom.
You too.
Take care.
We'll see you, Matt.